call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We're going to start off, just so I won't forget, by opening a very brief work session for purposes of possible reconsideration. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2065A.
Senator Morris moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2065A. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? It's not debatable, but it is explainable. Committee, this is to put a conflict amendment in the Scribner's bill that we passed out of this committee. The previous bill that we passed on the reconnect issue had a change in it that was not reflected in the Scribner's bill. So the change is purely technical. It's not debatable. Are there any objections? If not, the rules are suspended.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2065A was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves to reconsider the vote by which 2065A was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Now you can talk about it. Senator Telfer.
No, I was just going to have a little explanation on the need for it.
Dr. Warner, that's your cue.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the House Bill 2065 that you passed out of committee last week does have a conflict with House Bill 2157 that now has become enrolled House Bill 2157. That is the bill that fixed our connection to the federal tax code to December 31, 2008. So what happens when a bill comes out of committee, council goes through and checks to see if there are any conflicts with laws that have passed just prior to your voting out this bill. So when they find a conflict, what they do is prepare a conflict amendment, and that's what you have in front of you. It's the A2 amendment, and then this will make 2065 consistent with 2157 or with current law. And what happens as we get toward the end of the session, we'll see more and more of these kinds of conflict amendments.
Okay. Any other discussion? Is there any objection? Okay. The measure is once again before the committee. Now I will open a work session on House Bill 2065.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A2 amendments.
Senator Morris has moved to adopt...
3509, Madam Chair.
Senator Morris has moved to adopt the Dash A2 amendments dated 3509. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move 2065A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2065A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay. The bill is going to the floor. This does give us a chance, I believe, to change carriers. And Senator Telfer, if you'd like to, I will let you carry it.
I can't wait.
Senator Telfer, which I should have done in the first place, will carry this bill. That's why we had the whole problem, because I did it wrong in the first place. Okay. Now, we have one bill on our agenda here for public hearing, and that is Senate Bill 498, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 498. Good afternoon, Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 498 prohibits the Department of Revenue from applying or interpreting any law retroactively if such application or interpretation would result in additional tax liability, interest, or penalty for a taxpayer who complied with the law as in effect at the time the tax return was filed.
Thank you. We will start off with Tim Martinez and William Mann. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, and Bill Manny from Miller Nash, who is a tax counsel to the OBA. We're here to briefly discuss Senate Bill 498. I know you have some few folks signed up behind us. I want to begin by thanking the Department of Revenue. We took this concept to the department last fall and visited very briefly about it then with them about the bill. And then earlier this year, after it became in print, we've been meeting with them quite regularly, trying to come up with some language that accomplishes the goals that we're here to talk about, as well as work for the department. I'm pleased to say that I think we're fairly close. We met with them as late as last Friday to try to come up with some language. I think they're going to share that the language that they gave us towards the end of last week. We're not ready to agree to that. We have some of our own proposed changes. But again, I thank the department and the director, Deborah Buchanan, their legislative person, for working with us. And I'll leave it to Mr. Manny to kind of explain the details of the bill, if that's okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's currently an Oregon administrative
Mr.
rule.
Mr. Manny, could you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Bill Manny. I'm with Miller Nash. I'm here representing Oregon Bankers Association.
And I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
That's quite all right. Everyone does. So I wanted to point out a couple of things with respect to current law that is background for this bill. And the first is Oregon Administrative Rule 150-305.100B, which currently states that all administrative rules adopted by the Department of Revenue apply retroactively to all applicable periods open to examination. And I also wanted to point out ORS 314.410 and a 2002 decision of the Oregon Tax Court called Hallmark Marketing Corporation, together which stand for the concept that in Oregon, we have a very lengthy statute of limitations with respect to open tax years. It's not uncommon for taxpayers to have their tax returns open for Oregon purposes for even 10 or more years. So the focus of this bill is to make sure that when a taxpayer files their return in accordance with the law that's in effect at the time they file their return, that is the end of the matter, and to make sure that rules and statutes, except by caveat of the legislature, can't be applied retroactively to those open tax years. The bill really is focused in two areas. One is the need for taxpayers to have certainty and an understanding of what the law is, and in conjunction with that, to have fair notice of what the law is, and that usually comes through promulgation of statutes and regulations.
Okay, and Mr. Manny, we sometimes, even though we are nearly perfect, sometimes we don't get it quite right. And this happened in 2007 on the issue of taxation of natural resource property left in wills. And so I wanted to just get on the record that you're not talking about limiting our ability to apply something retroactively if we realize that an interpretation has been made erroneously, and we can see that the language is confusing, which was the case here. And we went back and we cleared up the language and did an interpretation that was different from the way others were interpreting it.
And that was an act of the legislature?
That was an act of the legislature.
Well, there's nothing in the bill that will limit or restrict the legislature's ability to create a law that applies retroactively. It's solely a prohibition on the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, you'll recall that we came to you at the end of the, when you first became chair, to do the bill in 2008 dealing with the real estate issue on the sale of out-of-state real estate, when that bill that passed in 2007 had some ambiguities, I'll say, to be polite, and you were very gracious to fix it. So we're not trying to interfere with any of your responsibilities as the legislature. And if I could, I'd also just like to point out very briefly that, you know, I've been around here since 1991, not as long as some of the folks behind me, John Marshall, if he's paying attention. But this is the first time that I've seen, you know, business groups come together on one bill. You have not only the Oregon Bankers Association, but you have the OBA out of Portland, OBA Light, as I respectfully call Mr. Deckard's group, AOI, PBA, Smart Growth Coalition, and others. So we think this this legislation is well thought out. The bill you have before you is not what you'll see ultimately, as we are, as I said earlier, working with the department to craft some language that works for both sides.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this bill in any way, or will the bill, when we see it, in any way affect the protective claim process or procedures?
I'm not sure I understand.
So we file a protective claim because we know there may be a court case or something coming down the pike that may reverse something we've done on a tax return. You know, we filed it with
on behalf of a taxpayer?
Right.
The bill specifically excludes any retroactive application that would benefit a taxpayer, but it's not intended to have any effect on a filing of a claim for refund or any action like that.
Okay.
Senator Telfer, what is a protective claim? How does
protective
that work?
Protective claim is whereby you file something because the current law says this is how you record a transaction, but we know there's a court case coming down the pike or that the something may change it so that would reverse it. The statute's going to close that year for amending, but the protective claim allows you to go back in and amend a prior year tax return after the statute has closed to reconcile the way you recorded the transaction to the law change.
And is this something that's done only for the benefit of the taxpayer?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Telfer, I understand your question better, and I don't think it should have any effect on that. For one thing, the prohibition in the Act is against the Department of Revenue, not in any way affecting a taxpayer.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Elizabeth Harchenko is here from the Department of Revenue. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, members of the committee, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I brought my lawyer with me.
That's always a bad sign.
Marilyn Harbor. Marilyn is a Senior Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice and has been helping us work our way through the issues on the bill. I have some written testimony and a draft of some alternative language, and I want to affirm what Mr. Martinez described to you as the process we've been going through. We've been conferring intensively over the last week or so with Mr. Manny and others about the goals that they have and the way the language of the bill is currently written. We have some technical concerns, but we understand the goal that they're after. So I would like to just give you a little bit of history about why we do things the way that we do them, so that you have the context for what the change is that's being requested. The department has had the rule that Mr. Manny referred to that says that our administrative rules will apply to all periods, tax years, that are open to examination or audit. And we've had that rule since about 1986. And as he mentioned, for income tax purposes, periods open to examination typically are 3 years after the return is due, but we also have a statute that does reopen Oregon income tax returns for review and audit if there's a federal adjustment. Whenever that occurs, And there's a recent statute that was passed that if there is even an adjustment in another state for a taxpayer that pays taxes in Oregon and another state, if that adjustment would affect assignment of income to Oregon. So it is true that, especially for very, very large taxpayers that are seemingly under constant review at some level or another, the statute of limitations for audit can be a very long one indeed.
Excuse me for interrupting, but is this applying just to corporate taxpayers or individual as well?
Madam Chair, the bill as currently written is not limited as to what tax program it applies to. It applies to all rules. One of the things we've discussed with the proponents is to limit it to corporate tax.
But the comments you just made, do they apply to just corporate taxpayers?
Madam Chair, the really long tail tends to apply mostly to corporate taxpayers, but individual income taxpayers will also have federal audits and adjustments. They tend to be processed a little more quickly. It's business and a complex return that ends up taking longer.
Thank you.
We adopt administrative rules for a wide variety of purposes. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk to you about today, I started out with sort of the natural three, which are to try to explain what we understand about the laws that you pass before and until such time the court might actually be called upon to interpret the law. To exercise authority, legislative authority that you delegate to us to decide tax policy. And an example of that would be the legislature has delegated to the department the authority to waive penalties that are imposed by statute. And we have pretty wide discretion in deciding when to do that and how much. And we have rules that specify what the conditions are under which we will consider waiver of penalties. We adopt rules to inform taxpayers of the standards that we're going to use to determine whether they have complied with the law. So standards about what books and records we need to look at, standards for justification for a deduction or a credit. Oftentimes we will have administrative rules that describe those standards. We also adopt rules to illustrate for taxpayers how we think statutes work, whether it's a single statute or several statutes that have to work together, or how the state law and federal law work together. And finally, we use administrative rules to inform taxpayers about procedural requirements, such as if they need to make an election in connection with filing a return, we usually have a rule that tells them how to do that. So we also, in addition to through our rulemaking process, we also often will end up interpreting or applying statutes or our own rules in the context of reviewing a tax return. So an auditor will have maybe looking at a tax return and looking at a particular item on the return, and we'll look at the statute. We'll see we don't have any administrative rules interpreting or explaining that statute, and then we'll try to just apply the statute in the context of that return to determine whether the taxpayer has complied. Over the last few years, the department has been trying to be more transparent and do more adoption of administrative rules so that we can give taxpayers guidance on the front end and say, here is how we understand a statute, here is our practice and procedure, here is our policy, and doing that more rather than less so that the guidance that taxpayers want is out there for them. We don't always get everything the first time. Sometimes it takes a few iterations and a couple of tax years have to go by before we see everything that we need to see and include in a rule. There are also a number of constraints on our rulemaking power. The first is we can't adopt a rule beyond the authority that you give us. We can't change the laws that you pass by simply adopting rules to the contrary. We cannot interpret the law differently from what the court tells us the law means when the question has been before them and they've decided that. And we also cannot apply the law or our rules in a way that violates the federal constitution or the state constitution. We're required by the Administrative Procedures Act to give notice of rulemaking. We're required to give interested parties an opportunity to comment. We have a pretty healthy process, I think. We go through a process twice a year, give public notice, always hold a hearing, asked for public input. We've had great contributions that have made by the bar and by the practitioners on many of our rules in the past. to the bill, as we've talked with the proponents, the primary example that they've given us that they explain as the reason that the bill has come forward is a case that involved what I would call a tax policy rule. There's a statute in the corporate law that says to the department that we're to determine the method for apportioning or allocating income of financial institutions and utilities to Oregon for corporate tax purposes. For all other business corporations, the legislature adopted a statute that's called the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, and it specifies an apportionment formula that started out being a 3 equal-weighted sales factor, property factor, and payroll factor, but which the legislature has changed to now pretty much just a sales factor apportionment methodology. But for financial institutions and utilities, the Uniform Act did not apply, and there's a separate statute that says that the department is to adopt by rule that methodology. So the rule that was made applicable to financial institutions had a property factor and a payroll factor and a sales factor, and the property factor said include the cost of all of your real and tangible personal property that's used in a state in the year. And there was another part of the rule that said that if the factors didn't fairly reflect the way that the taxpayer did business, the taxpayer could ask for a change. So we had a situation where a financial institution said much of our business, if not most of our business, is in intangible property, loans, mortgages, financing leases, and we think that to fairly reflect our business activity, that needs to be in the property factor. And we said, no, our rule doesn't allow that, and we ended up in litigation. And the court said, well, under the circumstances, it looks like for this taxpayer, intangible should be in the factor simply because that's the nature of the banking business. So once that decision was announced, we had taxpayers who, when the statutes were open, filed for refunds by amending their returns and including intangible assets in their property factor. So the department then adopted a rule that said that for financial institutions now the general rule was intangibles as well as tangible property in that factor. And under our default rule, that new rule or that change policy applied to all open years. I think that's probably the genesis of this situation, is that there were some taxpayers who were able to get a refund by including intangibles in their property factor and redetermining the income that was apportionable to Oregon using that method, but other taxpayers had additional tax liability. So there was a substantial amount of litigation over that, and in 2007, the Supreme Court held that the department did have the authority to apply that rule to tax years that were before the date the rule change was adopted. So after having much conversation with the proponents, we understand and respect the need that they have for predictable rules, for a clear set of guidelines to follow at the time that they file returns, and we also understand that they want some reasonable assurance that the rules won't change after they file. But we also believe that as the tax administrator, we have to be mindful of the effect of our behavior and taxpayer behavior on the general fund. And I think that's probably the genesis of our rule, that we've learned through experience that we cannot anticipate all of the different interpretations or positions that might be taken with respect to a particular statute. Words I have learned through my career are a very inadequate way to communicate. They can be interpreted differently based on people's different experience, and even a collection of words carefully crafted can be viewed through one lens and one experience in one way and through another lens and another experience in a different way. So we learn often through the examination of returns and through cases just and through the maturing of our administration, what the issues are, and then try to respond to them through our rulemaking process. And if we are confronted by two reasonable interpretations, we're more likely than not to fall off the fence on the side of protecting the general fund. So I would close by saying we have a draft that reflects just the current stage of discussions that we've reached with the proponents. I've appreciated very much their candor and their willingness to understand the concerns that we have. I think our primary concern is that the bill as drafted isn't limited to our rules. It uses the word law, which I understand to be both statute and rule, and I am very concerned that that if not focused on administrative rules specifically and the application of those rules to taxpayers in a way that creates additional liability retrospectively, that we do risk some potential unintended consequences if the statute were to be asserted and litigated in court by others who would want a broader result. So we would prefer the bill only limit our authority to apply rules that have a retrospective effect to any taxpayer when that retroactive application would result in additional tax liability. And I'm happy to answer questions, and I think Ms. Harbor also would be happy to answer any questions if you have about the text in the statute.
Can you say that last part again, that you want to limit this to cases where the retroactive application would result in additional taxation?
When you look at the bill as introduced, that is the focus,
right?
That retrospective application has an adverse effect on the taxpayer is what, as I understood Mr. Manning's testimony, is what the bill is designed to prevent. It is not designed to prevent retrospective application of a rule that would benefit taxpayers, allow them to reduce their liability, only retrospective application when it would increase liability.
Right, but are you endorsing that approach?
Madam Chair, I'm trying to be sure that the committee is understanding what the two perspectives are. Mm-hmm. I can understand, appreciate, and empathize with the challenge of taxpayers trying to comply with the law as they understand it at the time they file, and with the long period of time that a statute of limitations can be open for modification, for review of a return, that if we in the intervening time have adopted a rule that significantly changes what they understood the law to be, that there's exposure then, there's financial exposure for the taxpayer. We have not had many that I've been able to find, as in talking to my staff, many situations where the issue has been one of as much consternation as this individual case. But I understand the concern, and actually, as I said, we're trying to be a little more transparent these days by doing more administrative rulemaking, trying to be more prompt after adoption of statutes, of getting our interpretive rules in place, process rules in place, and when we change policy, thinking very hard about should this really be a prospective only policy change. There are risks, as I understand it, about what happens if we adopt a rule, say it's prospective only, and the court then looks at that and says, well, does that indicate that the department thinks that their interpretation and understanding of the statute is correct or incorrect? So we have concerns about that we've discussed. It's partly just the language is very short, and sometimes short language is too simple for the complexities that are intended to be addressed. So I'm neutral on the bill. But as I said, I understand the concerns that the taxpayers have.
Okay, and I think, and you and I have talked about this before, but, you know, to be as clear as possible at the beginning and more transparent, as you put it, will solve a lot of the problems in advance. I guess my question is, one of my questions is, if you have, you file your rule and then the court overturns it, and says, no, you missed the statute. Mm-hmm. The rule should have said just the opposite. I don't know how often that actually happens. But where does a taxpayer stand when that happens, when the court throws out the rule?
Well, Madam Chair, one of a number of things could result. If we've simply misunderstood what the words of a statute mean or how they apply, and the court has corrected us, if we have articulated that misunderstanding in a rule, then we would have to modify the rule to be consistent with the court's decision, because as I said, we cannot say the law is this when the court has said the law is that. We have to correct this to that. So there's a self-correcting mechanism right there that the court has the final say about what the law says, what it is that the legislature has in fact enacted and what it means, and we must comply with that when the court has said so. So
right now, if that happened, would you reach back and do the correct interpretation as the court hands it down? Would you apply that to people whose tax returns were still open?
Madam Chair, yes, and for this reason, that if the court has said we misunderstood the law and the words of the statute have not changed, and the court says this is what this statute means, then presumably it's what the statute has meant since it was enacted. So if we had erroneously applied the statute, we would be correcting our rule, and we would be applying the court's interpretation of the statute whenever the statute was in play in an audit.
Okay, so this bill wouldn't change that?
Well, the bill, we don't know what the bill would do. What we've discussed with the proponents is having an express provision that acknowledges that if the court interprets a statute, that the department may apply that interpretation for all of the years for which the statute has been in effect.
Okay. And I assume you have adequate public participation during the rulemaking hearing for inconsistent. I mean, I would hope this didn't happen very often, where the court comes in and despite all your public hearings and all the comments and everything else, that you still got it wrong. I hope that doesn't happen that often. Is that correct?
Madam Chair,
not often.
It doesn't happen very often. When I think about our litigation, most of our litigation is in the property tax area, mm-hmm. and it's about values. Some of our litigation does involve interpretation of our own rules, and we've had the court say to us a couple of times, you know, I read your rule differently than you read your rule, and this is what this collection of words means to me. And we either say, okay, we accept that, or we go back and look at the collection of words and say, well, if we were trying to accomplish something else, perhaps we'd best change them. But we will do one or more of several things. If we have a court decision that tells us that we misunderstand a statute that was enacted by the legislature, we might come back to the legislature and say, here's how we understood this collection of words as we interacted with you about what you meant. And if that's not the outcome that you want, then you'll need to change it because the court has told us this is what this collection of words means. At that point, the legislature would also have the ability to say it's either retrospective or from this point forward if the words of the statute are changed. If the legislature doesn't change the statute, we will have to change our rule if it's inconsistent with the court decision. And then we'll indicate whether it's under the general rule, it would be retrospective because the court has said this is what this collection of words means and they haven't changed. Okay. If it's a policy decision where we have administrative policy making authority that you've given us, the court might tell us the scope of the statute isn't broad enough for the way we've exercised the policy and we need to bring it more in line with the statute. So there's a variety of different ways the court gives us information about what the statutes mean and how they circumscribe the authority that we have.
Okay, but the legislature would always, even if this bill was adopted in some form, the legislature would always be able to come back and say, no, this is what we actually meant, and it is retroactive.
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay.
All right. Other questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question, I'm looking at your draft that you just handed us. The original bill talks about a taxpayer. Your draft specifically addresses corporations.
Correct.
And so your draft is specific to corporations and not all taxpayers.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, as we discussed the issue with the proponents, I inquired what is it that is that is energizing the bill and the need for the bill. The example was related to corporate tax. We have many, many, many tax programs, not just personal income tax and corporate tax. We've got tobacco and 911 and tire fees and a whole lot of other things. And I said, are you concerned about all those other programs, or are you really mostly concerned about corporate tax? And they said they were mostly concerned about corporate tax. So we asked them whether they would be willing sort of to give this a test run if the legislature was going to go with the measure, to focus on the area where they perceive the problems, which is the corporate tax area. So that's why the draft focuses on corporate tax.
Follow-up, please. Thank you. So given that, how will this be applied to the pass-throughs of S Corporation shareholders that are affected by any changes at the corporate level, or LLCs that are taxed as an S Corporation with that pass-through feature?
We better put that on the list to figure out explicitly.
Okay. I would just make a comment that this is very complicated, and I would really encourage you to pursue the path you're pursuing, which is to narrow it down to a problem that already exists.
Okay.
And then if it goes into effect and it's effective, we might want to then think about extending it to other applications. But I'm always nervous about trying to be too global about things, because there's always something some glitch. And I would rather have a narrow glitch than a broad glitch. So we have an opportunity to try this out in a narrow way, and I'd encourage you to keep going in that direction. But that's an excellent question about how S-Corps. Yes.
Just a response to that, if I may. My concern is that when the changes are done based on a rule interpretation at the corporate level, it obviously is going to, because they don't pay the tax, it's the shareholders. So that's why I would want to broaden the scope, I think, to incorporate those people that are, that's a little pun, but to take into account those taxpayers because it is affecting them, and it's a corporate rule change, corporate interpretation of
Correct.
The rules. So.
But if there's not a problem, if the problem is isolated to complex C corporation type of returns, then I'd rather deal with the problem that we know exists and then see how the other applications, to see if other problems come forward, because it's just a different different set of circumstances.
And, Madam Chair, we should be able to answer Senator Telfer's question clearly and accurately. Does it affect or does it not affect?
Right.
And if it does, how?
Correct.
For the limited liability entities.
Fair enough. Thanks. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, we will now create a panel, corporate panel here. Jim Craven, Jonathan Eames, and John Marshall.
Go ahead.
I think you're the dean, Mr. Marshall. I just heard from Mr. Martinez.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And contrary to popular opinion, when I started here, there were 36 counties. We were asked to join with the Bankers Association on this issue over the interim. And you may recall last legislative session there were issues, a number of bills were introduced by the Department of Revenue that applied their provisions retroactively, and you and your colleagues were kind enough to remove those retroactive provisions. And as Ms. Harshenko suggested in her testimony, I think what taxpayers look for are predictable and a clear set of rules that they follow. And this issue reminds me of trying to repair an airplane in flight. There are so many moving parts. We have federal We have state income tax law that you review every couple of years or perhaps more often. You have federal tax law that's constantly changing. You have issues relating to the extent to which Oregon, you make decisions about whether Oregon should connect or disconnect from those federal changes. You have the courts that are constantly reviewing appeals and making decisions that could affect other taxpayers similarly situated. So there are just a whole lot of moving parts. And while we would like to see certainly that, as I suggested, the predictable and clear set of rules under which our businesses operate, we also recognize and can appreciate the need for the Department of Revenue to very consistently and clearly, on behalf of taxpayers and citizens, to interpret and administer our tax laws in a way that we can all understand. So we're pleased that there are conversations going on between the proponents, the major proponents of the Senate Bill 498, as well as the Department of Revenue, and we look forward to supporting the outcome of those negotiations.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America. My last speech, that Tech America is the newly formed entity resulting from the merger of AEA, whom I've represented for 20 years in the building, and the Information Technology Association of America. So no more letters. We are Tech America, but it's the same folks that I've been representing in the past. We're pleased to support this bill. A number of us have been meeting regularly for the last several months, and we appreciate the committee hearing the bill and what sounds like some very useful conversations going on between the Oregon Bankers Association and their counsel and the department. You know, when the bill first got printed, it was probably too much to ask that we have just this nice little simple bill saying you get to rely on the rules that exist at the time you filed your return. You know, what's so hard about that? But we do understand there are issues and nuances when people start getting into it, and it looks like those are going on in a healthy fashion. I was asked by the advocates to point out to you that the handout you have that shows a redlined version of the bill bears no relationship to the bill that you have. I guess the regular font is the business side's proposal, and the amendments are the answer back from the department or something like that. So I was just asked by Mr. Martinez to point out that this is an amended version of the bill. This is like a whole new bill in front of you, just so you don't try to square this with the printed version. And finally, last comment, I appreciate the director's point that if there is an ambiguity, that they will err on the side or pick the side of the general fund. I guess at the end of the day, I think that we would all hope that the department would pick the side of truth and justice and what is the best outcome, and really allow maybe you all more to worry about the general fund and how we raise adequate dollars and such. But that's just a small comment. But we're pleased to see that good people are having a conversation. Hopefully we can bring you a final product soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Jonathan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here from PacWest Communications and representing the Smart Growth Coalition, which is comprised of a number of large companies here in Oregon: Intel, Nike, Schnitzer Steel, Columbia Sportswear, Tektronix, Monaco Coaches, Precision Castparts, and others. So, Genentech. We're for support of Senate Bill 498. And Mr. Marshall's actually a key person to listen to here, because at the turn of the century, when many of the antitrust bills were passed, he was here passing those. So I encourage you. You know, a lot of the support for this has already been expressed, but when we look at it and from conversations with a number of our coalition members, they look at investments of hundreds of millions of dollars into individual states when they come in, and a predictable, as John had pointed out, a predictable tax code where they can look at the laws and say, okay, we're going to make this investment, we're going to build this building, we're going to invest hundreds of millions and hire hundreds, if not thousands, of people to work here. If those rules are changed in the middle of the game, it makes it difficult for them to do that in the future. And I know from at least Genentech's perspective, they made decisions to come and invest in Oregon recently and are hiring currently based upon some of the tax laws that all of you in the Oregon legislature have put up. So that's what the context why we support this bill. And yes, it is much more detailed, but on the face of it, just the basic assumption that, you know, let's have predictability in the system, that helps encourages growth, that helps encourages companies to come to Oregon. So it's a good idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And, of course, one of the ways you get predictability is through clarity. So I presume your clients and all of your clients have people watching very closely during the rulemaking process itself. So hopefully any ambiguities can be solved sooner rather than later.
You bet.
I see. For the record, heads are nodding. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I encourage all the parties to keep the discussions going. It sounds like you're on a constructive track, and I hope we provided a little direction for that for the future, and we'll look forward to seeing this bill back in a different form. That ends our public hearing. That ends our agenda. Unless there's anybody else who wants to talk. Okay.